In this hour, Focus 580, we have a health topic for you, something that we do regularly throughout the year with different physicians that have different specialties. And every other month here on the program, we do a show on women's health. And our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She has a practice here in our area. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She also teaches at the med school. And she stops by here on a regular basis to talk a little bit about what's new in her field and also to answer questions. And that's really the chief thing, one of the things that we really want to do is have this be a resource for you. So if there's something in particular that you would like to talk about that has to do with you or someone who is important to you, please do take the opportunity to call in here and talk with Dr. Suzanne. The other thing that I do try to say when she's on the show, where other doctors are here, is that we can't diagnose over the phone because she can't see you. So there's a limit to what we can do with the program. But I know that she'll do her best. If you have some questions, she'll do her best to give you an answer. And then you may need to go on and pursue that with someone who can see you. This is a place you can start, though. 333-9455 is the number to call on to get on the air here on the show. 333-9455. And toll-free is 800-222-9455. If you had questions here, you can give us a call. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Is there something in particular maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about?
I thought we might talk about vitamins.
Okay.
I very often get questions from my patients to say, what type of vitamin should I take? What brand of vitamin should I take? And the National Institute of Health just convened a large panel where they discussed what is the current state of the knowledge regarding what they're now calling MVMs. Everything has to have an initial in medicine.
Multiple vitamin minerals.
Good work.
Thank you very much.
So it's MVMs, and they use that term all through their report. And you can go to the National Institute of Health website. It's, I think, one of those NIH.gov websites and get the whole report. And they concluded that in the United States, that there are probably very few chronic diseases that we know for sure can be prevented by vitamin intake. And one of the problems is that we have a pretty good diet. As you know, many of us take more than the number of calories in that we should. But with those calories, we have a lot of fortified foods. And therefore, it's not very common in the United States to have deficiencies other than in just a very few that we have talked about, unless you have a specific need. So some women who are young and menstruating, and particularly if their periods are heavy, they might have an actual iron deficiency, and that might need to be treated. But we're really talking about the average healthy person and what sort of vitamin intake. And after long discussion, a couple of days of hearings by many experts, they really came up with only two sets of general recommendations. They said that there are something like 13 vitamins and 11 essential minerals. And they looked at various research about all of them. And they didn't go back on any of their previous recommendations. So we still do recommend folic acid for women of quote-unquote childbearing years, because that helps to prevent neural tube defects. But the only two new recommendations that they really supported was taking in calcium and vitamin D for postmenopausal women to help protect their bones, and the use of antioxidants by adults to help prevent age-related macular degeneration, which is a common cause of blindness in the elderly. So that's where we sit right now. And one of the problems is that with all these fortified foods, we don't know we don't really know how to measure if you're actually getting too much of a particular nutrient. And that can be a problem. In fact, they looked at beta-carotene, which is a derivative of vitamin A, and they thought that that would be protective against certain types of cancers. And in actual one very prominently done study, they showed that it actually increased the incidence of lung cancer. So getting too much of a particular vitamin is not necessarily healthy for a general adult.
Well, certainly there are some that are, the ones that are fat soluble can build up in your body, and you can actually build up toxic levels of vitamins.
Correct.
So it's probably, I would guess that the general recommendation would be, if you want to take a multivitamin and mineral supplement that has, you know, 100% of the recommended of the RDAs, you want to take one of those a day, that's probably fine, but that when you start to take more of anything, that may not be such a good idea. Not only may it not be a good idea, but there's some questions about whether there's actually a benefit to taking more than the than what is recommended for your daily intake.
Sure. But if you do take a multivitamin that has 100% of any particular nutrient, and you're eating a cereal that has 100% of a particular nutrient, and some of our pastas and our breads are fortified, and some of our other foods have high nutrients, I think nowadays we feel that with the way they process fruits and vegetables and pick them so early so that you can be shipped from very far away and get your out of season everything that we get, some of those fruits and vegetables may be somewhat devoid of some of their nutrients. But in general, we may still be having very, very high levels. I know that in women over the age of 65, one of the reasons we're so adamant about calcium and vitamin D is that our natural ability to absorb calcium in our GI tract as we age goes way down. And they estimate that at 65, you're absorbing about half of what you would absorb at age 35. So that's one reason why they really focus on still the need for calcium. And we do see vitamin D deficiencies, and we've talked about that before. And we still do see that for adults, so that they were very interested in that. But in general, they say that the sale of what they call a supplement. Now, supplements can have herbals and things like that, but the MVMs just have vitamins and minerals. But they say that the business has been $23 billion business in the United States, something really, really incredible. And most of the supplement industry really is vitamins. And maybe some of us don't need to spend the money on that.
Well, there's the question. Let us say, and it's difficult to, you know, maybe sometimes difficult to determine, are you eating a healthy diet? But let's have an imaginary person that we're saying, okay, that we're saying that this person has a healthy diet. They're eating as if we brought a nutritionist in and they looked over their diet, the nutritionist would say, okay, this is good. Somebody like that, then, is there any benefit to taking a one a day in addition to what they eat?
Probably the quick answer to that is probably no. Unless you're a postmenopausal female, then you should add in your calcium and vitamin D. And also, we don't seem to get enough antioxidants because we don't eat very much fish. So now that's where the fish oil supplements and things like that, they're still giving some credence to that. And vitamin C is still considered an antioxidant. And in some vitamin E is an antioxidant too, but vitamin E's gotten beaten up in some of the recent trials where they had increased rates of heart disease on people with vitamin E. And I think one of the things that came out in this consensus is that we are going to have to do a lot more work, and we're going to have to try to figure out how do you talk to that patient or test that patient who seems generally healthy with that reasonably good diet and find out, do you have subtle nutritional deficiencies? And this has been something that's been talked about a lot, you know, hair analysis, skin analysis, blood test levels. You can test your blood level for homocysteine, which measures your folic acid level. So maybe some people don't need folic acid to help reduce their rates of heart disease, but some do.
We have a caller. Shall we talk with him?
Sure.
All right. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I have a teenage daughter, and in general, she eats a pretty good diet, but she's very slender, and that's, you know, it's genetic. So she's very slender and thin bones, and she's got Native American heritage. And I thought that, you know, she might be more at risk for osteoporosis. So I'm wanting her to take calcium, just a tons a day. And she insists she doesn't need it because she drinks plenty of milk. Well, I'm guessing her intake of milk is 2 cups a day. And she doesn't eat much cheese, and she certainly doesn't eat dark leafy vegetables. So So does she get enough calcium, or should I be pushing those tums harder?
Well, they probably would estimate that she needs about 800 milligrams of calcium a day, and that in those two glasses of milk, she might, if they were really big, you know, good-sized glasses of milk.
No, two glasses meaning two cups.
Two cups.
16 ounces.
Yeah, she probably could get at least 200. Yeah, you know, some of these things say 300, but at least 200 to 300 per portion. So she's probably getting at least 400 to 600 in her milk per day. But even like a potato would have 60 milligrams of calcium, and so maybe if you could split the difference and get her to take, say, a 500 supplement, even every other day, it would be good. You can look at the cereal packages; they're somewhat fortified,
yeah.
And you could buy orange juice that's fortified with calcium. So there are pretty easy ways to slip calcium into our diet, and you know, you could
tell me the total again. What she's supposed
probably
to get.
About 800 is for teenagers, and if you think she's got a little bit more high risk, and you want to err on the conservative side, probably 1,000.
All
but
you could
do it with foods, and you could show her the content in certain foods and certain supplements,
right.
and say, hey, you want to eat this broccoli? You want to chew this piece of chocolate? You know, there are chocolates that have calcium in them. Yeah, they're 30 calories. They're 30 calories.
All right, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to Matt Toon for the next caller here, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I hope you haven't already discussed this, doctor, but I've been wondering what the U.S. Required daily thing is for calcium for really old people like me. I'm 82.
They say that if you do not have osteoporosis, that you could go with 1,200 calories a day. But if you have established osteoporosis, they say 1,500. And again, you do want to kind of figure out where you are in your foods.
Yeah.
People used to talk a lot about overdoing calcium, but the most recent data is that if you don't go over 4,500 of calcium, that you're probably fine. And so unless somebody has terrible heartburn and somehow, you know, munching just any antacid almost around the clock, that's almost impossible to overdo with calcium. And for someone in their 80s, surely their vitamin D level is going to be low. And so you want to be sure that your calcium supplement has vitamin D with it.
Yeah. Does the Prilosec, I believe that's the name of it, and it isn't exactly an antacid, I don't think.
Yeah, it shouldn't.
Does it have calcium in it?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a medicine.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, very good. That's an interesting point, just because Tums, people do take them as an acid for that, but mostly what they are is a form of calcium. So if you want a cheap calcium supplement, a lot of people do use them for
Tums
that.
Tums and Rolaids are just pure calcium carbonate and excellent absorption, very inexpensive.
But also people shouldn't confuse that with some of these other medications,
right.
Some of them available over the counter that are for treatment of heartburn or for acid reflux.
Correct.
The Prilosec or the older ones like Zantac and drugs like that, they're something completely different. They work in a different way to make the body produce less acid, and what Tums do is they soak up the acid that's there, I guess, or they neutralize the acid that's there. So it's two different, completely different things.
Right.
All right. We have somebody on cell phone here, line 2. Hello.
Yes, I have a question about Fosamax. I understand recently that there have been studies showing that there are certain problems, specifically with osteonecrosis. There have been class action suits, and I'm just wondering what your feeling is about the pros and cons of Fosamax.
Well, Fosamax is a bisphosphonate. It's one of three currently available bisphosphonates indicated for the prevention and treatment of postmenopausal osteoporosis. And they're all excellent medications, and they all have a role in indicated patients. And these cases of osteonecrosis that have been seen few and far between. So very uncommon effect of the medicine. It's more likely in individuals that already had poor dentition, poor gum disease, poor tooth disease. And it's also been mostly reported in people with either cancers or multiple myelomas, and mostly with the cousin medicine bisphosphonates that are stronger, dosed differently and stronger. So it's a fact of American medical life that people think that we can solve some of these problems by class action suits, and, you know, being on the physician end, I have my own opinion about that. But definitely individuals should talk to their individual physician and find out if they have any factors that make them more at risk for that condition, and talk to your physician about alternative medications, of which there are several. There are SERM, selective estrogen receptor modulators. The one on the market now is raloxifene, but there are many in development. And of course, going on estrogen is an alternative. And so we're going to have some risks and benefits. And what you want to find out is not only what is your prognosis for thin bones, but what is your real prognosis for an actual fracture in the near future? And once people get serious bone disease, they may need other, even stronger medicines like parathyroid hormone, which can help actually build bone.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, and thank you. And next we'll go to Urbana for another caller. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, my question was also about Fosamax, and I think you've pretty well answered it, except I see advertised one that has vitamin D in it, is Fosamax D, they call it.
Mm-hmm. I think it, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. But I have had a hip fracture. I fell and fractured my hip 3 years ago, and my orthopedist said whenever you do that, you need Fosamax. So would you say the same thing?
Well, absolutely. Individuals who have fractures are at the greatest risk in terms of developing future fractures. Now, there are other components of your general health care. What's your calcium level? What's your vitamin D level? Do you have other diseases that might cause secondary bone loss? We need to make sure about that. Once you do select a medication to go on, then getting monitored, making sure that medication timing and dosage is right for you. They are doing some different packaging with both the Fosamax and Actonel, so that Actonel gets packaged with some calcium. And the way they do it is it's a once-a-week medication, and then on the days that you don't take medication, you take your calcium. And that's to remind that's to remind people to take something every day for people who actually will be less likely to forget their medication that way. And also to remind people you don't take your medicine right with your calcium, because that's going to adversely affect absorption. The Fosamax D has I believe it's 2,800 international units. So you divide that by 7. That would be about the equivalent of 400 a day, which many of us feel, if you have established osteopenia or osteoporosis, that you should be in the 600 to 800 unit a day range for vitamin D. You can give a lot of vitamin D at once, and it does quite well. People tolerate it extremely well. So it may be enough vitamin D for some people, but for some people it may still be on the low side and you may still need supplementation.
The problem, I have problems with calcium. I don't seem to tolerate calcium when I take calcium various different ways. It upsets my stomach. And so I probably better stick with the Fosamax, right?
Well, also, vitamin D does help absorb the calcium from your foods.
So, I do take a multiple vitamin.
Right.
Every day. I don't take the multiple vitamin on the day I take Fosamax. So.
And most multiple vitamins don't have very high intakes of calcium.
No, they don't.
But you want to look at how much total vitamin D, because then the vitamin D will help you absorb the calcium. And it is true that it's kind of a catch-22. It is true that if you don't have adequate calcium intake, that your overall bone health will suffer, and that by taking these medications, it can reduce your risk of fracture. But if you read the package insert of these medicines, they don't work unless you have an adequate level of calcium intake. So I see many patients that in consultation that have gotten started on these medicines, but they've kind of dropped the ball in terms of monitoring their calcium levels and making sure their intake is good. So you want to balance that. And now we have the intravenous alternatives for patients. So that the newer one that's been advertising as a once-a-month supplement, Ibandronate, which the brand name is Beneva, that now comes intravenous form, so you can actually have an injection four times a year for people who can't tolerate the GI upset or can't tolerate the swallowing or just want it to be more convenient.
Yeah, but the once-a-month one is as effective as every month, every week.
Well, that takes me at least 1 to 2 hours speech to answer that question effectively.
Okay. I don't want
because
to do
the FDA has required, in order for a new bone health drug to get on the market, they require vertebral fracture data, and that's the easiest fracture data to get. Hip fracture data takes longer because it's less frequent occurrence and develops in much older individuals over longer periods of time. So the Beneva, the vertebral fracture data is excellent protection, and the hip and vertebral bone thickening data is very impressive as well. But Beneva does not have the track record that Fosamax has in the non-vertebral fractures in terms of their research because it's newer.
Right, yeah,
and
right.
It just hasn't been out long enough.
So probably better stick with Fosamax.
It's an excellent choice for many patients, but you got to stick with what your doctor recommends.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
Bye.
You. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She teaches at the U of I Med School for many years. She has been here to talk about women's health, and we've had a number of questions so far, and we certainly have time for others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What else would you like to talk about?
I thought I would talk about the human papillomavirus. The FDA has had a preliminary hearing regarding the new HPV vaccine, and we're hoping that the since the preliminary hearing was extremely favorable, and we feel that the new HPV vaccine, Gardasil, that is a vaccine against 4 of the 70 types of HPV virus, has the ability to prevent over 70% of cervical cancers and over 90% of genital warts. So I think that we'll be seeing a lot of that in the media. By the time I come back in a couple of months, we'll be able to know what the FDA has finally decided and hopefully have some information about who should get the vaccine and exactly the timing of the vaccine and that sort of thing. But it's really potentially one of the biggest women health discoveries in our century.
Mm-hmm. Well, this here, you put your finger on what no doubt is the big issue, because the vaccine is not going to do any good unless you give it before a woman, a girl, gets exposed. So that means that you're going to have to give it before she becomes sexually active.
Correct.
So then the question is, okay, what are we going to, when are we going to give it?
Well, not everybody gets exposed from sexual activity. We know that approximately 50 to 70% of college students that come in negative by the end of or do not show any exposure to the human papillomavirus by the end of college, they will be positive for the human papillomavirus. So we have the ability to still target some adults who have not yet been exposed. They have published some studies on younger individuals, literally vaccinating young women between ages 9 and 12. And it's going to be somewhat controversial. We do know that if two individuals are virginal when they begin their sexual activity, stay mutually monogamous, that theoretically they would never be at risk for cervical cancer. But in spite of reported monogamous relationship, we do still see conversions to positive. So vaccination seems like it's going to be the best strategy.
Okay. Well, we have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I missed the compound that Dr. Troopman said to take for macular degeneration prevention.
Well, they're saying antioxidants, and specifically of the vitamins that are known to be antioxidants, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, beta-carotene has been shown, and omega-3 fish oil supplementation, which isn't a vitamin, has also been shown to help prevent macular degeneration.
Okay, and that last one is available over the counter?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And let's talk with someone in Marshall, Illinois, on our toll-free line. This is line four. Hello.
Hello. I just have a question for Dr. Troop, and I'll ask it, and then I'll hang up and listen to her response.
Mm-hmm.
I received one of these scary emails from a woman who was sending it to other women, and they're emailing it to other women, scary health, women's health scare email, and I wanted to know what Dr. Troopman thought of it. This woman claims that she developed a peritoneal cancer that's actually a form of ovarian cancer, she said. Her doctor said at stage three by the time they diagnosed it. And she got it even though she said she had her ovaries removed, and they were removed. When they were removed, they were healthy. She'd had a hysterectomy, complete hysterectomy some years ago. And she was warning other women about the signs and symptoms, saying it was terrible diarrhea and constipation and bloating, and it was a long time before it was accurately diagnosed. And she went on to say that the simple blood test that cost $75, the CA-125, could diagnose it, and that it really should be done routinely for women like the PSA is done for men. And I just have no idea if any of this is accurate at all, and I'll hang up and listen to Dr. Troopman's answer. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, this is one of these discussions. The answer is yes, no, and maybe. Absolutely, it is true that a small percentage of cases of ovarian cancer are diagnosed in women who have had ovarian removal. We're not sure of all the reasons for it, but our ovaries start life up near the kidneys in our fetal life, and they sort of migrate down to their position in the lower pelvis during fetal life. And so there's some theory that there's microscopic ovarian tissue that's left during this migration process. There's also some theory that when ovaries are removed, that perhaps not all the ovarian tissue is removed. Now, in somebody that has a healthy pelvis, let's say she's having a hysterectomy for something wrong with the uterus, and maybe or a condition where having the ovaries might make her at risk for things later on. But her ovaries are essentially absolutely normal. Very easy surgically to completely remove those ovaries, but there are medical conditions where the tissue becomes more or less fused with the surrounding pelvic structures, and it's probably almost impossible to literally remove all traces of that ovarian tissue. So we tell patients that their lifetime risk of ovarian cancer is about 1 in 70. We tell women that she has about 2 to 3% risk of developing ovarian cancer, even if she should remove her ovaries. And just as sort of a sidelight, not really in answer to your question, we are recommending that women under the age of 65 who don't have any abnormality with their ovaries consider not taking the ovaries out at the time of hysterectomy because of recent risk-benefit analysis that favor keeping your ovaries, which preserves health in other ways. Now, in terms of what are the signs and symptoms of ovarian cancer, whether you have ovaries or you do not have ovaries, we always used to say that ovarian cancer was hard to diagnose because it's a silent disease. And now we've sort of changed that tune and we say it's a quote-unquote quiet disease. But you're right, some of the symptoms are very nonspecific. Bloating, abdominal distension, abdominal discomfort, gas, very somewhat subtle symptoms that could be a symptom of a variety of non-serious conditions. So that as clinicians, as we listen more for these kinds of symptoms, we are doing a better job of diagnosing ovarian cancers earlier and earlier that may have been missed. In terms of blood markers to diagnose ovarian cancer, the CA125 is elaborated by some ovarian cancers and can be a blood test that can pick up ovarian disease. We really recommend it in somebody with a strong family history. When they do the research studies on women with ovaries, now this is different. Your email talked about when you already have your ovaries removed, but most of the research studies have been done in healthy women with no real complaints. What you're talking about in terms of screening, so these are healthy women with ovaries still and doing CA125 tests, and the research studies are done in two different ways, either using it by itself or in conjunction with a routine ultrasound done about once a year. And it is true that we can find some ovarian cancers, but it's also true that we have to sacrifice about 350 women's ovaries to find one cancer. So that is a lot of operation and a lot of morbidity and potentially more serious complications just to find the one cancer that maybe we could have found other ways. And we assume the numbers will be even greater in these women who've had their ovaries removed. We're going to have to really be hunting for needles in the haystack. So what I'm currently telling my patients who are at high risk, if they've had ovarian removal and they're having symptoms, then yes, that's a patient that should have the blood test and the ultrasound. If they're not having symptoms, let's just continue to talk. There are other ovarian markers that have been tested but do not seem to be, again, clinically useful because they're not sensitive enough, and they flush out too many people that would need surgery to try to track this down. So it's a very complex topic, but there are some elements of truth, and I haven't seen this particular email. I've seen some that are similar, but there are some elements of truth in what the email is talking about.
Okay, hope that helps. Let's talk again with someone else. This is Urbana and line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. The current issue of Consumer Reports on Health is focusing on minerals and the right amounts. Mm-hmm. And one of the things it says, and I've read this before, is that we can get too much iron, and that it's recommending that every adult have a one-time $250 blood test for hemochromatosis, which I gather some people retain iron. I would imagine that women are much less likely to have hemochromatosis, iron buildup in the tissues, because we have periods. And if you have heavy periods, maybe not. And also I would imagine that giving blood would help. Our family hasn't been able to give blood because we lived in England for 8 months back in 1980, and that's the first year when they said, "Up, if you lived in England for more than 6 months, you can't give blood anymore because of the mad cow disease scare." Even though it's been 26 years, I haven't been able to give blood. So I'm wondering whether women really, how does a woman decide whether she needs this $250 test?
Okay, I'm going to have to think about that answer and get back to you. When I came out of medical school many, many, many moons ago, we did a lot more routine blood work than we do now. And then we went into this cost savings era where we did very few screening blood tests, and now we've gotten back to a little bit more of a happy medium. Recommendations are to be tested once you get past the age of 40, you test for thyroid disease every 3 years, you test your cholesterol every 2 to 5, depending on your family history. You get screened for diabetes every 2 to 5 years, depending on your family history. So we've got that group of patients that is being screened for various, and then there's an entire set of recommendations that you may or may not want to follow. And then you get into the group that needs to be tested because they have some signs or symptoms, and they may be subtle. For instance, if you say, "Are you tired? Are you fatigued?" Well, now, since pretty much all my patients seem to answer yes, we can get into a lot of different things that we look for. And most of these more what I would call exotic blood tests, all the benefit, they do these what's called cost-benefit analysis. So that, for instance, screening for certain blood clotting disorders, if the test only costs $10, yes, we should do it. But if the test is going to cost more like $100 or $150, and we're probably only going to pick up maybe 6% of the population that has even heterozygous form, well, now our cost-benefit analysis is just not going to pan out. So what has to happen with some of these tests is they have to get cheap enough to show that the number of people that you're going to find based on this screening test alone is going to then save you in health cost savings. That's why a pap smear is so worthwhile. It's very inexpensive, and it dramatically reduces our rates of cervical cancer. So it passes muster in terms of cost-benefit analysis. So it's not so much what the test is or how rare the disease is, but it's how available is the test, how accurate. Now we have a lot of accurate tests that we didn't have before. So that has changed the mix somewhat. But I didn't see this report. And in the National Institute of Health, they did not talk about screening for that. But it is true, some adults can get too much iron. And so you have to think twice in terms of iron supplementation as you get older. You're right. As if you're a young female that's cycling, you're bleeding it out. So iron supplementation isn't that troublesome. Fortunately, for most of us, we can't tolerate the levels of iron supplementation because of the side effects of oral iron, which is why there's so much research, and I participated in some of this, for intravenous forms of iron, because you build your rates up so much faster if you are deficient.
Well, part of their point is that the consequences for those who have it are serious and they're irreversible once the problems develop. So,
but I'm wondering if it would be almost a question for a pediatrician. You know, they might test people even before they're older, as you would have it as inborn. So
yeah, but we're talking 60-year-old adults now.
Yeah,
but we don't. The daily vitamin I chose has no extra iron, and that's what they recommend, that you not have iron for adults over a particular age. Somewhere on here I saw, and I can't find it now, that there was something relating to impotence. I thought it was calcium, but I'm not sure. Low blood levels of calcium either affects cataracts or affects impotence. Oh, I can't remember which one it was, and I can't find it here.
And they're both bad.
Yeah, they're
I'll have to look up this hemochromatosis, though.
Pardon?
And I don't know if that's something as routine screening that insurance companies would cover.
Oh, my
that
God.
I don't know.
But anyway, I do recommend this article on this.
Sounds like a good one.
This newsletter is inexpensive and keeps you on your toes. Thanks.
No, thank you. Well, I do. I do think it is true that when you look at those the multivitamin mineral supplements that are formulated for quote unquote older adults, that is people over 50. I think one of the big differences between that and the one that's for younger people is they don't have any iron in them.
Correct. And it's because you can get iron toxicity and build up, because you're not losing the iron that you would lose. You lose some, but not like you do when you're younger.
Yeah. We have a couple minutes left. Is there something else that you'd like to, or have we not quite done it on any of the other topics we've talked about so far?
Well, I brought some interesting statistics regarding causes of death. I think last week was like National Checkup Week for women, something like that, but I missed it. I think a lot on the internet was publicizing getting women to get their routine screening, and they said that over half, about 55% of women did not comply with their annual checkups, and therefore we still do have a lot of individuals that aren't complying consistently with recommendations. Now, if you look back over, say, 3 to 5 years period of time, most people have seen a physician during that period of time. And a lot of people have seen physicians just for their cold or their flu or something, but they really haven't still completed all their routine health screenings. And just by getting individuals to comply, we feel that we can lower our preventable disease rate, because we feel like heart disease in particular is significantly preventable for young individuals. And the American Heart Association has just revamped a lot of its recommendations regarding what your blood pressure should be and what your overall levels of blood fats, triglycerides, cholesterol, both the low density and high density cholesterol. And they really are still pushing medication if you can't get your cholesterol levels into the recommended ranges for mm-hmm. your different age and your health sequence. And they do have really good risk assessment scores out there. There are two or three in wide use, and you can get to a lot of them on the internet, and they'll predict what your chance of having a serious cardiovascular event are over the next 10-year period of time. And for individuals in the modest to higher risk categories, they really need to comply and get their blood pressure down, get their cholesterol down. And if they don't go for a regular checkup, they're not going to probably be able to know where they are with respect to that.
Yeah. Just something that I actually was happened to see the Chicago Tribune this morning, and as I was interested to see an article about this movement towards using contraception for women to have fewer periods, which is something that we've talked mm-hmm. about quite a lot. And basically the point of the article, I guess, was that there are more and more women, particularly young women, who are doing it and who have taken contraceptives this way. We talked about the fact that there are some that are actually now packaged that way.
Correct.
But I guess that you wouldn't have to do it that way to take them continuously. And so to take it in a way so that rather than having a period every month, maybe you had 4 periods a year or 3 periods a year. Or I guess there are some people who go and they don't have any periods.
They don't have any. The problem with that is that not everybody's body will comply. And about 50% of all individuals who try to have fewer cycles, they will have less bleeding, but it'll be more unpredictable. So it'll be more like inconsistent spotting. And so most people prefer a light period to inconsistent spotting. So there has been a new trend. There have been two new birth control pills released probably since I actually last did the show. One is a form of Loestrin, which was already out there, that's packaged 24-4, and one a form of Yasmin, and I think it's called Yaz, that's packaged 24-4. So traditional birth control pill cycles have been 21 days of active pills and then 7 days of essentially you just don't take anything, or you can take fake placebo pills. And during those 7 inactive days is when women would have their menstrual cycle. Well, it turns out the longer you go off your active hormone, the more likely you are to have escape ovulations. So that for individuals who take that full week off, and then if they miss a pill that first week when they're back on, they're a little bit more likely to have escape ovulations. So that's bad. They're a little bit more likely to have the start of ovulation, so that it turns out their lining builds up a little thicker, so they'll have heavier periods. So there's less PMS and lighter menstrual bleeding if you just go to a 24-4. So it's not completely doing the continuous cycles. The other way you can do it is piggybacking the 21-day cycle. So instead of having a 3-week hormone active time, you can have 6 weeks. We used to call that bicycling, or 9 weeks tricycling. Mm-hmm. We try to be cute about everything to help you remember what you're doing. But but you're right. It helps reduce menstrual cramps, PMS, reduces the rates of endometriosis, reduces the rates of ovarian cysts. So having longer cycles on oral contraceptives has significant non-contraceptive health benefits mm-hmm. for women.
Well, there we will leave it with thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, for being here. We're now doing every other month, so that means we'll see you, I think, next in July.
Sounds good.
Right?
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Dr. Troopen has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the U of I Med School, and every other month this year we talk about women's health.